With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Deep Dish Radio, episode 19. All-around fun guy and rock and roll keyboard player, Andy Kahn.
Hey, welcome back to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers, and this is my show. You like my new microphone? I got a new microphone today. I thought you might take that. Hey, listen.
My guest today is Andy Kahn, and Andy is a session musician. He is a music demo producer, and he played keyboards for the Turtles, for Flo and Eddie, among a zillion other acts. The guy's amazing, and he's I keep saying it throughout the interview, but he had a front row seat at the greatest era of rock and roll. And really, he's a cool guy. You're going to enjoy meeting him. I met Andy in Palm Springs just a few weeks ago, actually. I was having brunch with my mom, and Andy was just had a gig playing piano at the place where I was having brunch, and we just struck up a conversation, and the guy is amazing. I had known of Andy's work before and have a few of the albums that he played on, not the least of which is Illegal, Immoral, and Fattening by Flo and Eddie, and he also played on the Monkees album Pool It. Now, there's some controversy about Andy, and we actually put that to rest here today. There's a rumor that Andy is the guy that created the opening bars, the piano that you know, from the Monkees' hit Daydream Believer in 1967. Is that true? Is that not true? Andy says so right here. In the meantime, I'd really appreciate it if you tell your friends about Deep Dish Radio. Make sure that they know about us. Make sure that you go to iTunes, leave a nice comment about how much you enjoy the show, if you do. And you can email me directly. I would welcome that. I'd love to hear from you. My email address is tim@deepdishradio. That's tim@deepdishradio, of course. You can follow us on Twitter @deepdishradio. And there's a Facebook page. So punch in, go to Facebook, look for Deep Dish Radio with Tim Powers, and that will be that. I'd like to give a shout out to my friends at Zilch, the Monkees podcast. Ken and the guys over there and the ladies over there do a fantastic job of a Monkees podcast, and I appreciate them giving me a shout out. I'm returning the favor. And if you dig the Monkees, or if you are a fan of 60s pop culture, or you just have good taste in music, I invite you to check out the podcast called Zilch. It's available wherever fine podcasts are sold. Lots of great stuff happening here, and would love for you to be a part of it. Hey, speaking of Monkees, I want to tell you about my friend Emily Dolenz. You've heard me speak of her before, but she is a very talented fine art photographer who is selling prints of her work, and it's really knock your eyes out good. You can check her out on Etsy. If you go to Etsy and you punch in Emily's name, it's spelled exactly like you think it would. Alternately, her Facebook page, facebookpage.com/EmilyDolenzPhotography. And, of course, she's got a Society 6 page where a lot of her work is available for sale. Society6.com/EDolenz. And you will see some art prints and tote bags and travel mugs and you know, pouches, pillows, things like that. And it's exciting stuff. It's great work, and Emily is just incredibly talented, and I encourage you that if you are a fan of beautiful artwork, beautiful photography, flowers, hearts, and all kinds of just beauty through someone else's eyes, you're going to want to check out Emily's stuff. So go to the browser of your choice, the search engine of your choice, punch in Emily's name. It's Emily Dolenz. Now here's Andy Kahn.
and let's talk about how this began. You said you've been doing this since 1965. So tell me the story, because every musician, every rock and roll fan, every radio guy I know has a story about when they know they had the bug. They know that first single, that first note that made the hair on their arm stand up. Where did it start for you?
It started sitting in class room at Show and Tell. I think it was fifth grade. Mr. Shubley's fifth grade at Junior Albert Leonard Junior High School Show and Tell.
Okay.
And somebody played a 45 RPM record called Runaway by Del Shannon.
Del Shannon's Runaway, sure.
We have to check our archives and find out what year that came out. But in any event, that keyboard solo, I learned it when I went home. I played the record and I kept on playing the record until I learned how the keyboard solo went. So,
and you did it by ear, or were you already taking lessons?
Never took a lesson. I actually lied. I took one lesson.
Wow.
And the one lesson was this lady, and she was very nice, and she was trying to teach me how to do a scale. You know,
right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I couldn't do it. She wanted my finger to go across my thumb and jump over to that finger and do this clumsy, and I couldn't do it, and I gave up on getting piano lessons. But then, of course, I'm probably repeating the same word that millions and millions of musicians repeat, is because of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan with their frickin' Beatle boots and their ties and Nehru jackets and the Hodger and the Country Gentleman and the Rickenbacker and the Ludwig. I'm done. And the Beatle Vox Super Beatle amp. Forget about it.
Right.
No, it became my life. I wanted to be a Beatle when I grew up.
Didn't we all?
So that really did it to me, because I was busy making monster movies with all my friends, 8mm Sound, 1962,
right,
63. And that was fun. I was using classical music, you know, De Meistersinger or... you know, the Flying Dutchman Overture or the Rite of Spring or all these cool-ass classical music. And then the Beatles, of course, just like completely changed my life immediately. And I began to write all these songs that had flatted fifths and minor thirds and all these cool changes when you least expect it, and nice harmonies and, holy shit, my songwriting just like grew like a flower as soon as I heard the Beatles play, you know?
Yeah, I get it. Believe me, I am too young to have seen Ed Sullivan, and by the time I was musically aware, the Beatles were already a force of nature. So, but believe me, I get it. Every guy who picked up a guitar owes a little bit to Elvis and John Lennon. Runaway, by the way, came out in 1961 on the...
I'm glad you looked it up.
On the Big Top 45. Yep.
Yes.
February 61. I'm sorry I didn't know it off the top of my head.
Well, I'm glad you were able to carry on an interview and look information up both at the same time, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm good.
Unbelievable. He's good. Anyway, so what do I do now? I'm a Beatle guy, and I get this local band in New Rochelle, New York, and I start booking all the colleges, you know, Yale College and West Point and all these, Manhattanville College and all these, you know, big gigs, and I'd book our band for $100 a night, four hours.
You growing your hair?
We were all Dave Clark Five, because I didn't play guitar. I played the combo organ.
Okay.
With left hand is the bass that went into an Ampeg bass amp. And the right hand was the Leslie cabinet speaker. So literally I had a little miniature Hammond B3 with the bass. So it sounded really full. And I had the guitar player and the singer and the drummer. It was like... our version of, you know, and we had some pretty good stuff. I could play you a song I wrote called She's Gone Away that was produced by Roy Sisla, I think is how you pronounce
right.
his name. He produced everybody
wow.
in New York at his studio. So I was lucky enough to be one of the kids who wandered in there at, like, you know, 17 years old, 18 years old, whatever, 16, who knows. And he produced a great tune that I wrote, but we never got to put the vocals on it. But it's been released on these GarageBand compilation CDs that everybody gets.
Wow. Like,
it's called Johnny Farfisa.
Wow.
Originally released on Moxie Records. There was a collector's label by David Gibson called Moxie Records.
And it came out with just the instrumental, no vocals?
Right, it's just the instrumental, Johnny Farfisa. She's Gone Away, you know, Bomp Records carried it, Rhino Records carried it. It was like a little collector's thing. So that's kind of funny to be an unreleased guy that never came out, and then all of a sudden you're released and you become a garage band guy. So it's really funny. In fact, I was in New Zealand walking down the street because I was there with Little Richard or somebody.
Right.
And someone comes running up to me in the middle of this village on a cobblestone street in New Zealand, and he waving the Johnny Farfisa Moxie Records EP at me. He goes, Andy, sign it for me. I'm going, what? In the middle of New Zealand, one kid runs up to me with the Johnny Farfisa EP and wants me to sign it. It was the most hilarious thing I've ever seen.
And that is rock and roll.
Yeah, I mean, one autograph for one crazy guy in New Zealand, of all places.
That's really amazing. And that was your first recorded piece?
Yes, recorded at Bruno Dean Studios. It was a two-track recording. First, you lay down your band, you know, with like three microphones, one for the drums and one for the guitar amp and one for the piano.
Right.
And that's it, three mics. And it went on to a half-track thing, and then the other half-track was the vocal overdubs and the tambourine. And we had one chance per song. It wasn't multiple takes. We had to be rehearsed four songs. I think it cost, I paid for it all. It was like $25. It was a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, yeah.
Yeah, in 64, 65, whenever that was.
Absolutely amazing.
It was 64. Yeah. So I recorded a whole bunch of demos and had different bands in the 60s.
And then you moved west, huh? At this time, you were writing music, but you were, I would imagine, you were doing covers. What were some of the more popular covers that you guys were known for?
Oh, Satisfaction. We did it was Imagine the Young Rascals playing Satisfaction with the Hammond B3 with the full Leslie playing the slam, you know, the big Hammond sound.
Right, instead of like Otis's cover, you know, where it's got that groovy kind of key to it, you're
exactly, yes. And actually, I performed Satisfaction with Little Richard on the American Bandstand 20th anniversary show, like Otis Redding, where we did it like with the horn section, you know.
Wow.
It was hilarious. And Richard would be jumping around the stage for 20 minutes, and all he'd do is go, I can't get no! And he'd just wait, and then, I can't get no! And that's all his lyrics for the whole song. And he's sweating, and he's jumping. Everybody's, you know, going nuts. He gets the audience going absolutely insane.
That is what Little Richard is for, man.
Little Richard is the king.
Yeah.
And Chuck Berry's the king, too. You know, because I'm telling you, it's a funny thing. When I sat there at the Palladium, where they shot the Grammys for 1973, and Stevie Wonder won the award for Ain't Too Superstitious.
Right.
So Chuck Berry and Little Richard were hired the music introduction to the contestants of the best song of the year or whatever.
Okay.
You know, Barry White and all these other guys were up for the thing. So they take a Chuck Berry song like, you know, Johnny Be Good, and they say, Barry White, take it away, you know. And or they, instead of Tutti Frutti or Rudy, it's Al Green, He's Clean. So they changed the contestants' names for the Little Richard Chuck Berry hit records.
Wow.
And I was the music director, and I'm going to myself, Jesus, the Beatles loved and idolized Paul McCartney, idolized Little Richard and had to go woo and do all
yep.
that shit. And John Lennon loved the rock and roll of Chuck Berry's rhythm guitars and stuff.
Yep.
You know, the Chuck Berry rock and roll. And so the Beatles idolized that, and that would influence the Beatles to play music. Here I am with Chuck Berry and Little Richard, just the three of us, playing their hits.
You're hanging out with the Beatles' parents.
It's so hilarious. I mean, it's little things like that, when it's happening to you, you don't really realize how cool it was until years later when you look back and you go, holy shit, I was in a room with Little Richard and Jay themselves, just the three of us. And I go, holy shit.
Okay.
That's really amazing to me.
Now,
to me, that's amazing. I got to explain something.
Yeah.
I apologize. Because I'm a fan. I didn't start out being a musician. I started out being a monster movie maker.
Right.
But because of the Beatles, I'm a fan of it. So actually, when I meet really cool musicians in my career, I'm actually like a fan. You know, I'm not like a self, you know, like a peer, like another fellow musician. I'm acting like a fan. Like when I'm sitting there with Gracie Slick or Stephen Stills or somebody, I'm going, wow, you know, this is so cool.
Yep. And
so other people don't do that, but I do it all the time.
Because, you know, I got to ask, keyboard player to keyboard player, I'm not a player, but, I mean, you're a rock and roll keys player, and you're in front of Little Effin' Richard, right? And, I mean, on, well, that's got to be intimidating, man.
Actually, the best part about it was I would play the Hammond organ on stage, and he'd be on the grand piano. Eventually, he would jump off the grand piano and grab the mic and start running around the stage and doing shit. I'd get off the Hammond B3 and run over to the piano and take over. But I would watch him carefully. He's like a Jerry Lee Lewis. They both have the same... You know, the same...
Those 16ths?
Triplets.
Yeah.
The triads and the 16th. And they both... well, Jerry Lee loves to just, you know, washing up and down the keyboard
right.
and all. And sometimes they go on the high notes. They just make a clam, which is just random notes in a cluster that you go real fast on high. You know, on the high register on the piano, and it sounds awesome. It sounds like you really know what you're doing. But you're just slamming the frickin' piano at a very high speed and high notes, and it looks cool and it sounds cool. So that's one thing I learned by watching Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis. You could put your leg up there, and you can turn around and do all these movements, and it sounds great, too. Even though if you really analyze it, you're not playing any chords. You're playing rhythm and banging just random notes out. It's so fucking hilarious.
That's awesome. That's just absolutely incredible.
That's how I learned rock and roll piano, by Little Richard.
And
literally.
But you learned that before 73, right? You learned that
I mean, I was watching all these movies and stuff with the Dave Clark Five and... Mike Smith, you know, standing at his Vox Continental, the same keyboard that Ray Manzarek used.
Right.
Now, the reason Ray Manzarek used the Vox Continental was it had a flat roof, which allowed him to put a Fender keyboard bass up on top of the flat roof of the Vox Continental. But the Farfisa, the one I had, had a rounded roof, but it had its own left-hand bench built in the friggin' keyboard. There were black notes against white notes instead of white notes with black notes. You know, they were the opposite color notes.
Was there a difference between the ranges that you guys had?
Well, yes. Ray Manzarek's Fender keyboard bass was like 2.5 octaves.
Right.
On the Farfisa combo compact organ that I used that had the built-in, it was just about an octave and a half.
Okay.
But it was enough to get your real low pedal C and E and stuff. And it was really cool. I play left-hand bass and right-hand with the Hammond B3 organ, and it made us sound so full. It was unbelievably great.
And you didn't have to deal with a bass player in the band.
Yeah, and that's what made it really tight, because the drummer and I were tight. My left hand was right with him on the drums perfectly. And the guitar player was really good, and our singer was great. And we won all the Battle of the Band contests in Westchester County, 1964, 1965, and 1966.
Wow.
Yep.
So you're winning contests in 1966. Rock and roll changes between 1966 and 1967.
Yes, that's when I took the LSD during the period of the release of Sgt. Pepper.
So
the entire summer of 1967,
right,
which was ironically the same summer Happy Together came out.
Right.
I was taking the Purple Osley, 1,500 mics of Purple Osley. It looked like an Oscar the Grouch trash can, and it was purple. And it's LSD pure from Timothy Leary's pharmacist, Osley.
Osley, yeah, you had the original Osley.
I had the original. It was like 99.9% pure lysergic acid 25.
Okay, so set the story up, Andy. How did you get it, and where were you?
New York City, hanging out with Andy Warhol's dancer by the name of Diana Hall, who used to come see me play in Rye, New York with my band.
Right.
You know, with my little John and Farfisa band. We were called the Individuals in our heyday. Anyway, so she took me to New York, and then I was able to score Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll in New York, Greenwich Village.
Wow.
Hanging out.
So,
and I went to see the Fugs play. Remember the Fugs?
I do.
And I was sitting there with Dr. John next to me, and in front of us was Bob Dylan and Keith Richards. And we were watching the Fugs at the Cafe Wa or whatever in Greenwich Village.
Absolutely.
This is all cool shit, you know, that I go, oh my God, I can't believe I did that.
You're living history, man. You're living history. And you probably had better drugs than Dylan and Richards at that time.
Well, you know, pot today is very, very, you know, yikes.
Right.
Very good. I don't need much at all. Just, I don't. In the olden days, you go through a whole frickin' ounce in a couple of days. But, you know, I don't need much with my age and with my life. I'm fine. I'm a happy camper.
Right. I mean, we've gone in a couple of different points, you know. We talk about the Individuals and the great days of the hard scrabble rock and roll days. And then next thing we know, you're the music director for the Grammys. Connect those dots for me, Andy. How'd you get there?
Oh, boy, that was a good one. All right, so here we go. I moved to California, worked for my mom's friend, Erwin Garr, who was an ABC Dunhill executive with the Mamas and Papas, and opened up his own label, Pulsar Records, with Graham Bond from England, the guy who brought the Mellotron to the United States, the guy who had a band with Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce called the Graham Bond Organization.
Right.
And so he was my guy. I was assigned as an office boy with a VW bus to go get coffee and to go pick up contracts and go take the musicians to the recording sessions, I was the gopher for $35 a week.
And this is about, and what, 68 or so?
68, yes.
Yeah.
September 68. And so there I am, and Graham Bonds calls me up and says, Andy, why don't you just throw your harpsichord in the car, and we'll go drive over to TT&G Studios on Sunset, and we got a session. Oh, great, fine. And then Mitch Mitchell was setting up his drums. Jack Cassidy was tuning his bass. Lowell George had a little piccolo flute. Graham Baum was on the Hammond B3, and I was there putting the legs on my Baldwin electric harpsichord. And then in walks Jimi Hendrix with two girls, blonde girls, one holding his guitar and one holding his amplifier. Then he decides to sit down right next to me, set up, and start playing. We played like the blues for 2 hours straight.
Gotta love it.
It was hilarious. It was so cool. And his veins were popping out of his neck and all this stuff. So anyhow, so that happened. And then a week later, I will be getting to the How I Met Little Richard and Chuck Berry, but I got to tell you the story on the way.
We got to get there, Andy.
It's
cool.
In the studio with Jimi Hendrix, Graham Bond says, you know, I got a call from Buddy Miles, and he's playing the Del Mar Racetrack tomorrow, and his drummer is sick. So we need another drummer to fill in his place. Do you have any suggestions? And I knew the stuff Buddy Miles did, so I said, I'll do it. So they had the drum set there.
Right.
I was on stage at Del Mar Racetrack a week after being in the studio with Jimi Hendrix.
And you're drumming for Buddy Miles.
Buddy Miles. With the double drummer. I was on the stage with the two drum sets. Everything Buddy did, I did. It was all the same shit. Boom, boom, chack, boom, 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 chack, boom, boom. And that's a fast song. The slow song is boom, boom, chack, boom, boom. It was the same freaking rhythm.
Yep.
It was hilarious. So, you know, I'm in the harpsichord playing with Hendrix. A week later, I'm playing drums for Buddy Miles. So then I meet this guy, Scooby, Frank Sorkin, and, Dr. John and the Night Tripper, Matt Rabinack, was also signed with this record label. So I went on the road with Dr. John. And, oh, man, the stories go on. Anyway, there's so many stories. I'll never get to Little Richard and Chuck Berry.
Well, the good news is that if you're digging Andy's stories, keep an eye peeled, because Andy is compiling these into a coffee table book that will be available in the not too distant future. So if you're digging these stories, stay tuned, and we'll tell you how to get that book when it comes out. In the meantime, you're jamming. You are just the right guy in the right place at the right time. Somebody says Buddy Miles needs a drummer, and they go, "How about you?
Right. How about me?" And I, you know, I love to play drums. It's, you know, I'm the easiest drummer. Ringo Starr was my teacher. I would live the life of Ringo Starr's drumming in my dreams. Boom, boom, jack. You know, all of his rhythm. He was my teacher.
Absolutely amazing.
Because it's very simple. It's all simple. And it's all pocket drumming.
Did you play left-handed?
The first time my cousin, Barry, gave me a drum set when I was 10 years old, I put the floor tom in front of me. And the snare drum was to the right of me where the floor tom usually goes.
Right.
And it still worked. So then somebody said, hey, you got it in the wrong spot. The snare goes in front of you.
Right.
And the floor tom goes outside. So, oh, really? Oh, yeah, I guess so. Okay. So everything is just caveman with me. I just learned by mistake.
It's just instinct and repetition, and then you get it down until you can do it yourself. That's really, really amazing and impressive. So.
So, yes, go ahead.
So, man, you're the guy on the scene. You're working at a record label, 68. You're hanging out on the Sunset Strip. You're jamming with Hendrix and Buddy Miles, and things start to open up for you, right?
Dr. John the Night Tripper was in the same office with Graham Bond. He was one of the artists on Pulsar Records. So Andy was hired by Dr. John to play the harpsichord on some gigs. In fact, his wife, Lorraine, bought a VW bus because I had a VW bus. And we were going to drive from California to New York to Toronto and play all these concerts on two VW buses. And that's what we did.
In the days,
and I saved all the flyers and stuff.
In the days before cell phones and CB radios, you guys just had to trek across country.
Yeah, it was 1968. You know, you have your diners and telephone booths, and just picture it, 1968. Pretty amazing. Or 69, actually.
Crazy.
So it's pretty amazing. So Dr. John walks me in after we finished this tour with him, and we did all the stuff from his Babylon album and stuff. And so he walks me into the Musicians Union in Hollywood in 1969, and Frank Sorkin, also known as Scooby, was the head of the musicians, you know, booking nightclubs, and, you know, all the rock and roll musicians went to Scooby.
Right.
So Mac Rabinac, Dr. John, pinned a note on my shirt. And the note said, "He's good. Put him to work," or something like that. You know, just like a little. So he guided me into the offices. And of course, you know, everybody knows who Mac Rabinac is. So Scooby says, "Hey, wow, how are you?" And so, "This is Andy. Help him out. Get him a job." and he just got me. Scooby got me every gig in the world immediately. All the local stuff that was going on. He networked me with other musicians. He put me on picket lines. You know, I'd make $25 a night picketing a nightclub that didn't pay union scale. And then he turned me on to Jimmy Carl Black, the Indian of the Mothers.
Yeah.
So you're kidding me, because my first marijuana experience was listening to Freak Out and listening to Help, I'm a Rock. You know. So that was my first marijuana music, listening to Jimmy Carl Black going, "Ka-doom, doom, chack, ka-doom, doom, chack." You know, it was the waltz, the triplet.
Yeah.
Anywho, so here he is. Jimmy Carl Black comes over to my house with the Roy Estrada, the bass player.
Right.
And so we started Geronimo Black, this band. And we played at a church with Greg Block, the violin player from Southwind or something, and Dr. Lauren Newkirk on a synthesizer. It was just a weird arrangement, but we went through several sets of musicians until we finaled with Ray Collins, you know, the singer with Zappa,
right.
And Bunk Gardner, and Jimmy Carl
Buzz, Black. Right? Buzz Gardner, too?
Buzz Gardner played on our stuff, sure.
Right.
Denny Wally played on Joe's Garage. You know, it's just all Zappa-related musicians. And I eventually put out three albums called The Grand Mothers, which is all the members of the Mothers of Invention.
Right.
Without Frank Zappa, all the stuff. Without Frank, all their stuff. So it's pretty cool stuff. I sold a bunch of those on Rhino Records, and I had my own record label called Panda Records, where I put out the Grandmother's Fan Club Talk album, white vinyl square, with a Cal Schenkel iron-on transfer for your T-shirt. And, you know, I went totally Looney Tunes, because I copied everybody else's thing, and it was fun. I did the Leaves. Jim Pons was the bass player with the Turtles and sang lead on Hey Joe by the Leaves. And we put out a die-cut green vinyl picture disc of a leaf with the song Hey Joe by the Leaves.
Right on.
And I also put out an album called The Leaves 1966, which has two unreleased versions of Hey Joe, plus the original.
Yeah, you want to hear Hey Joe, the leaves is the way to do it. Your producer on Geronimo Black, if you remember.
Yeah.
That was Keith Olsen, right?
Oh, my God. What a funny time that was. Keith is the coolest guy I ever met.
Now, to bring the listeners up to speed, Keith produced Rumors, Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, right?
Yes, and that happened right after Geronimo Black left the studio. He was actually hiring Stevie Nicks as a maid to clean his house. This is the truth. This is the absolute freaking truth. When Lindsey Buckingham got together with Nicks and they made their solo little duo albums,
right,
and stuff. But that Keith Olsen did that whole thing. He was the mastermind behind Fleetwood Mac's sound. Yep. You know, that whole thing. He arranged all that stuff. They're great musicians and singers, but Keith Olsen, the way he suggests, he's like a George Martin.
Yep.
You know, he brings out the good in you. Well, like when I was doing a harpsichord track on my album, he was guiding me through it so I wasn't nervous. So I could do it without any mistakes. Because when you're under the gun like that and you're a solo instrument, you got to be really good.
Yeah.
Especially the harpsichord.
Yeah, so harpsichord's tough because you don't get a lot of there's not a lot of flexibility. You hit the note and that's what you get.
Yeah, and it's plucking. It's not striking like a piano with a felt. It's a plucking like a pick.
Right.
It boing, plucks the note.
So no matter how hard you hit that key, you're going to get the note regardless, right?
Exactly correct. But there are harpsichords with this soft pedal, and it changes the whole height of the strings. But in any event, yeah, that's really cool stuff. I love the harpsichord. It's one of my favorite instruments. So the song on the Geronimo Black album that was Russ Regan signed us in 1972, it was called Quaker's Earthquake, and it has Scott Page, a really great oboe player, on it.
You're kind of in the Zappa universe here a little bit, because you're playing with these guys, you're playing with these amazing musicians, you're working with the grandmothers, and then these vocalists appear in your universe, and you start working with Howard Kalin and Mark Volman from the Turtles, and the Mothers, Flo and Eddie. Tell me how that happened.
That was through Craig Kranz and Cherokee Studios. When I was with Jimmy Carl Black, with Geronimo Black, we'd go to Box Canyon and do different sessions at Cherokee. And Richard Nader just did a tour in a movie called Let the Good Times Roll. And Craig Kranz had to do some bass drum overdubs for the Little Richard segments. So I went there, and Flo and Eddie were there recording a soundtrack to a cartoon called Cheap, or another working title was Dirty Duck.
Dirty Duck,
and
right.
It was a Merricombie Swenson Wolf cartoon that Mark and Howard were the voices of the characters. So I met them at Cherokee, and they had a band with Bruce Robb, the keyboardist and engineer at Cherokee Studios. He was too busy engineering. So, Mark Volman said, are you available? We need a keyboard guy. So I said, sure. And they gave me a tape of the stuff, you know, from the first two Flo and Eddie albums. And I learned all these great songs and went on the road with John Bredo and Gary Rolls, and I forgot the bass player's name. And then after that, that was 1973. And ever since then, I've been playing with Mark Volman and Howard Kalin.
So
that's when that started.
That's really cool. And you were the producer of Howard's album from, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, Dust Bunnies. Which is
That is hilarious. Yeah, I'll tell you the quick story behind that.
Okay.
We were doing a Turtles concert in Belgium. And on the bill was the Box Tops and the Procol Harum, the Monkees, and one other band, Peter Noon, you know, Hermits.
Right.
So we're all on this airplane flying to Belgium, you know, and I'm hanging out with Davy Jones and shit. And Mickey, I'm friends with all these people.
Right.
In fact, Mickey and I walked around Belgium looking at, red light districts. And of course, nobody recognized Mickey. It was hilarious. Here I am walking around with frickin' Mickey Dolenz in Belgium, and nobody recognized him. It's hilarious. So anyhow, so the Monkees, and you'll have to remind me what I was just talking about. I just had another loss.
You were telling me about how you got into producing Dust Bunnies for Howard.
Oh, Dust Bunnies. Good. Okay. So Howard and I are sitting on this airplane, and I said to Howard, dude, I'm the demo doctor. Why don't you come over to my house, pick out 10 of your favorite songs in life that you always wanted to do, but nobody ever wanted to do them. He says, you know what? I'm going to do it. So we recorded 10 songs of his favorite songs, personal, that nobody ever did, except for one of them he co-wrote with Mark Volman,
right,
that we did as a demo, and another demo we did a long time ago. But I re-recorded them on my Insonic Performance Sampler 1988 sequencer sampler. And that was the whole band. It was just me and Howard in making this demo. And David Spiro, a friend of ours, through Harry Nilsson and through a bunch of other stuff, he said, Billy Bob Thornton wants to meet you and wants to help you out with your album. So Howard and I went over to Billy Bob Thornton's house, which used to belong to Slash, which used to belong to Roman Polanski, which used to belong to Roger Corman, which used to originally belong to Cecil B. DeMille, which had a tunnel underground during Prohibition leading to a phony storefront on La Cienega to the Roxbury Drive mansion where they'd have their parties. Anyhow, so I'm in Billy Bob Thornton's frickin' studio.
Right.
You know, hanging out with him at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, you know, could you do Carl for me? You know, from Sling Blade.
Right.
I was sitting there with Hank Williams Jr.'s daughter, Holly Williams.
Right.
And Billy Bob and me. I was smoking a J. She was drinking wine. He was drinking wine. And I just said, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, I said, you know what? Do you mind just doing Carl for me? And he kind of looked at me like he was ready to kill me.
Right.
And then he just calmed down, and he was in a studio swivel chair, and he just kind of swiveled around with his back toward me and Holly. And then he just crunched over into this Frankenstein mode, and he swiveled the chair back, and he was Carl. His face was distorted. He scared the living shit out of me. He says, Yeah. And he twirled his hands and he said, I'm here with a turtle. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, and I was freaking out. That was the most amazing thing, to have Billy Bob do a private performance of Carl for you right there.
Wow.
You know, shit like that happens, you know, and when it's happening, you don't really realize how cool it is. Like I said, until years later, when you look back at it and go, holy shit. I was sitting there with this guy named Billy Bob Thornton, and he does his lead role that made his claim to fame for me, private performance.
And he didn't kick your ass when he thought about it for a second.
I know. He looked like he could have murdered me any second. He literally had this vibe coming off of him like a sicko wacko. And that's how good of an actor this guy is. This guy is amazing. So he was shooting Bad Santa at the same time we were recording Howard's album in his basement.
Right.
So we got to see all the rushes of Bad Santa, which was very cool.
That's really exciting.
So that was quite an experience producing that album with Howard. To know that the guy who sang Happy Together has picked 10 of his favorite songs of life that they always wanted to record. And it came true.
Not only did he record them, but he rearranged them, to fit to fit Howard. His cover of "Have I the Right"? Whew! Wow!
Oh, I got to tell you the story about that. We were sitting at a sushi restaurant with one of my demo doctor clients, Larae Springsteen, and she was a Jewish princess who had no hearing. She had hearing aids in both ears, and she was a singer, and she was one of my clients at my studio. So as she came to a Turtle show, we were having sushi with Howard, talking about recording this album, and I mentioned the song "Have I the Right" by the Honeycombs,
right?
You know, which is a very fast, up-tempo girl drummer song. Up-tempo.
Then
all of a sudden, Howard says, "Why don't we completely turn it into a Phil Spector, slow tempo, ragdoll song? You know, like Ragdoll, Four Seasons."
Right.
And that's how we went with, really slow. And with a timpani drum and a big bass and boom, have I, all kinds of, dramatic, slow stuff.
Right.
So that was interesting doing that version. That was a good version. All the rest of the songs are basically copied arrangements from Tim Buckley and from the guy from the Left Bank. Who was the lead singer of the Left Bank?
Oh, now you're putting me on the spot.
Oh, you might have to look it up while we're talking. I'm sorry.
I got the which cut?
Well, he did Don't Walk Away, Renee, but there's two cuts on the Howard Kalin album, Dust Bunnies, that are written by that guy. If I had the titles in front of me, I could point them out to you. Night Deer, ba-ba-ba, da-da-da-da-da-da, Night Deer, ba-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa. Oh, well, I can't remember shit, my brain doesn't work sometimes.
And that's why we're recording this, Andy, because this is history, and we got to preserve this before it goes away.
Hey. Well, that's how I'm writing my book. I don't sit there and type it. I'm looking at all these tons of photographs and documents.
Right.
And talking into my computer. I have the voice recognition, and I just hit go and start talking.
Awesome.
And I edit it, make it, correct it, and then grammar and spelling.
Well, that's what we're doing here, too. Hey, one of the names that we have brought up that we haven't really gone into was your good friend Harry Nilsson. And you were a big part of Harry's life toward the end there, man. Everybody who was touched by Harry has that story.
Well, first of all, I was nervous as shit. My job was limousine driver for Flo and Eddie in the 1989 Alice Cooper Clarence Clemens Oktoberfest at Universal City Studios. They had 30 radio stations.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This cross-country set up in tents up on the top level of the amphitheater at Universal, and all the celebrities would go from tent to tent and do interviews. I was with the K-Rock Flo and Eddie tent from New York, and they got a limo, and my job was to pick up Eric Burdon and Bobby Hatfield and Elvira and Ed Meaney and Richard Lewis and Harry Nilsson and Dean Torrance, and pick them up, take them over to the tent. I'd have my keyboard at the tent, and we'd do Happy Together with the celebrity guests, and we'd also do their hit record. So like with Eric Burdon, we picked an Animal song. With Dean Torrance, we did Bob Oran with Bobby Hatfield. We did the song from Ghost, Unchained Melody, because it was number one when he was sitting next to me in this tent singing that song while I'm playing the piano. Yep. I mean, God, what an amazing episode that was, to have all these celebrities sitting there with Mark and Howard. You know, Mickey Dolan comes in, and we do I'm a Believer. And Mark and Howard are singing Davey and Peter. So it was really cool, you know, doing all this. So Harry was one of the guests on the show. I went out to his house and picked him up, and I opened up the back door of the limo. He says, "Fuck that, I'm sitting up front." And he sits up front and he lights up a Camel cigarette. And at that time, I was going out with this girl who I was smoking her cigarettes, which were Virginia Slim 120 lights. So here I am sitting there in the driver's seat, lighting up a Virginia Slim 120 light, and Harry looks at me like, "What are you doing?" And he rips it out of my mouth and he gives me a Camel. He says, "Here, have a real cigarette, you know." And we're driving in traffic, and he's telling me all this shit about John Lennon.
And eventually you get to Universal, but you guys form a bond.
Unbelievably, when I took him home after the radio show, which I do have a live recording of the show that I posted on Facebook and YouTube already.
Right.
Anyway, it was a Dillard song. By the Dillards, and it was a really cool song. So Flo and Eddie and Harry sang the song, and I played piano. Then I drove Harry home. And on the way home, we stopped at Hawkeye, which was his motion picture script organization that would supply scripts to movie companies.
Right.
So we stopped there, and you know, he said, "Would you like a glass of water or something?" You know, and it was really nice. And then he invited me over to his house, and I says, "Don't you play guitar anymore? Don't you play your piano?" He says, "No, I'm just doing my Hawkeye stuff. I'm not really doing music." I says, "Excuse me, you're Harry Nilsson. You're supposed to be doing music." And he looked at me, and he said, "You know, you're right." I said, "Dude, I'm the demo doctor. Let's just once a week get together and get creative, and we'll just make some demos."
You got balls,
and
man.
That's exactly what happened. And he bought it. He got a guitar. He bought a new synthesizer, and we every week we got together, and we acted like a bunch of teenage kids in high school, laughing and smoking and just really fun. I mean, I couldn't believe it was Harry Nilsson. But once you're with the guy, you forget who he is. He's the most wonderful, funny, intelligent, smart guy. The guy was so smart. Unbelievably smart.
Was this Harry's house? This was his house up on Mulholland?
Well, he would hang out at my Laurel Canyon studio all the time.
Right.
But even before then, I had a place on Tesby Street in the valley. And that's actually where we recorded the soundtrack to the movie starring George Segal and Joe Beth Williams called Me, Myself, and I. It's on IRS Films. And Pablo Cruz was the director.
Wow.
Anyway, it was a very cool movie. We cut a four-track cassette of Harry singing the song that he wrote for the movie, and we put it on a DAT tape. And that is the soundtrack for the frickin' movie. And we went to the premiere of the movie in this big theater with the big screen and all this shit. And Harry and I are sitting in our chairs going, we're giggling. We're going, this was recorded on a four-track cassette. You know, and we're laughing. You know, it's a big production with all these people in tuxedos and the wine and the thing. And we're sitting in our chairs going, four-track cassette.
And
so that was really fun.
But, I mean, you guys are pros, so there's not, like, the high-end hiss that you would get on an old, you know, 1978 Sertron cassette. You guys, you were able to compress it, but you're right. It's still...
Fidelity of the demo doctor stuff was minimal. It was minimal fidelity. It was demo quality. It wasn't, you know, it could have been broadcast quality. There were some mixes I did that were, even though it was a stupid four-track cassette, the way I recorded everything and the way I mixed it, it sounded full and rich and great. So I still was able to, unbelievably enough, get great stuff. And then finally, I got an ADAT.
Oh.
It was all digital, and I had no generation loss. And I had 32 tracks of sequencing on this thing, and I had 750 instruments, you know, from harpsichords to violins to oboes, flutes, and clarinets, guitars, and everything. So that was a whole other world of the demo doctor with Ringo coming in and doing voiceovers with Harry in my living room. And, you know, Eric Carmen bringing John Wesley Harding over and recording, and Harry bringing Mark Hudson over. And
there's a couple of stories I want to get into there, because this at the time that you're doing this, this is a very good time for Eric Carmen, because he's just coming off the charts from the Dirty Dancing soundtrack.
Well, he also made a ton of money on that last movie that just came out. I'm his Facebook friend. He just made more money than he ever made in his frickin' career.
Because they used Go All the Way?
It's like triple billion platinum. It's like he's like stunned. And when Celine Dion, or was it Mariah Carey? One of those two did All By Myself. Who did it? Mariah Carey?
Yeah, I think so.
She had a big hit with it. And that brought him more money than his original release back in the 80s or whenever it was.
Couldn't happen to a better guy.
So, he saw my picture in the Music Connection magazine with Ringo Starr, and he calls me up. Hi, he's secretary. Hi, I'm Eric Carmen's secretary. I said, Eric Carmen? She said, yeah. I said, oh, okay, sure. And he would like to book some time. Okay, yeah, let's do it. And he brings John Wesley Harding in, and they redo a song. And then he decides to do 30 songs that he wrote before he was in the band The Raspberries, prior to The Raspberries. So these are demos that he had to get out of a publishing deal with. He had to submit X amount of songs to get out of the deal. So he picked all these pre-Raspberry demos and cut them in my... ADAT studio. So I did 30 songs with Eric Carmen in there.
Right.
That are awesome. And they're all like 60s stuff.
So where are these songs now? Why isn't Eric putting them out? Where are they now, and why isn't Eric putting them out?
I'm his Facebook buddy. I should say, you know, Eric, for fun, you ought to release the Andy Kahn demos of your, unpublished pre-Raspberry material, which is, the quality is excellent. The bass, the guitars, the keyboards, and the vocals are excellent. Really good mixes. I'm very proud of the Eric Carmen stuff.
Is it just you and him, or are there session guys on it?
The two of us. That's it. He's playing guitar and keys and bass. and I'm engineering and singing background vocals.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we hear that right now? Here's Eric Carmen and our friend Andy Kahn. The song's called I Need Your Lovin', right here, Deep Dish Radio. Said Harry brought in Mark Hudson, and
yes.
I really dig Hudson's production a lot. In fact, just yesterday, as a matter of fact, I was playing through some of his old Casablanca records when he was playing with Bill and Brett, and man, those are good records. Those are great records. And you know, I've never had the opportunity to meet the guy, but I interviewed his brother Bill when Bill's book came out, and you know, there's just such an affinity between the two of them, and I'm just a fan of Mark's work. Can you tell me a little bit about working with him and Harry?
It's a very interesting situation that happened.
Okay.
Harry recorded 4 24 track big studio recordings with Mark Hudson before I met him.
Okay.
And nothing really happened. They're sitting on the shelf. And then when I met Harry, he would talk about Mark. He played me the demos and blah, blah, blah. And he's kind of, Harry said to me, you know, I'm a little disappointed because Mark never returns my calls and stuff.
Okay.
So it was kind of drifting. It was a drifting thing. And so there were phone calls and communications, and Mark knew he was, Harry was in the studio with Andy now. And so he wanted to get involved. And he came over one of the last recording sessions before Harry died. Harry did a song that he wrote about me called Rescue Boy. It's the same thing as High Heeled Sneakers,
right,
but he changed the word to Rescue Boy.
Wow.
And it's basically about me. So Mark Hudson and I were sitting there, and I had timpani drums on my synthesizer. So Mark is doing the Chuck Berry with timpani drums. And we both laugh and go, how fucking cool is that? You know, so he was very creative. Very creative, you know, because when you have a synthesizer with all these interesting sounds and then you play them in a strange way, it becomes very cool. So that's what happened when we cut Rescue Boy. The timpani drums played like a Chuck Berry, you know, that kind of a guitar lick. So that was very, very cool shit that we did with Mark. He was a lot of fun working with me and Harry on that one of those last songs.
Wow.
But that was my meeting. And then, of course, at Harry's funeral, Mark was the one of the speakers at the service.
Right.
And he did mention that Harry was always with Andy. You want to know where Harry is? He's over at Andy Kahn's house doing demos. And that was what happened, literally, for the last 4 years of his life. He had, 10 kids at home and a wife, and he was never home. We were always hanging out, driving around at 4 o'clock in the morning and laughing and singing his songs at the top of our lungs. You know what I'm saying? Just like, can't live, you know,
yep,
stuff like that.
Yep.
I can't sing to save my life. But when you're sitting next to Harry Nilsson while he's harmonizing with himself, blasting his music, you're in heaven. You're going, oh, my God, this is amazing.
Such an amazing voice.
But,
were you at, and I ask this with respect, and I mean, it's sad that Harry's gone, but were you at the burial out in Woodland Hills?
Yes, I was at the wake of my good friend, Zach, an artist that Harry and I knew very well. We sat together at the wake and looked at Harry's body and stuff, and then the funeral was another day.
Right.
Or whatever, at his house. So Jeff Lynne and, George Harrison and, what's his name? Kermit the Frog's songwriter, what's his name? The guy who runs ASCAP. What's his name? The short little funny guy.
Oh, Joe Raposo?
ASCAP. The little funny guy. Oh, why are there so many songs about rainbows?
Oh, Paul Williams.
Paul, yes. He was there. Jim Keltner. Everybody was there at the funeral. So everybody takes the limos and their cars a long way around this driveway to get to the gravesite from the chapel. And so George Harrison and I were the only two who chose not to ride in the car. We walked over this grassy knoll, the shortcut to the grave. And I'm walking with George Harrison. I go, hi, George. My name is Andy Kahn. Oh, Andy Kahn, Harry spoke very highly of you.
Wow.
And I went, oh, my God, thank you. And that's all I said to George Harrison. That was the entire extent of our full conversation, because it was a funeral. You don't want to go, hey, dude, you're a Beatle, I really like you,
Right.
All I just said is, my name is Andy Kahn, and he says, well, Harry spoke very highly of you. And that was the only words that George Harrison said to me. And then he died 2 years later or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was a while, but
so
yeah,
was,
you're right. It was, oh man, that's sad as hell. But I mean, you get to walk with George. I've been to Harry's grave, and it's a long walk from anywhere. So you guys had some time to walk in silence. The story that I want to verify, though, is while Harry's while they're laying Harry down, the rumor is that there was a chorus of "fuck you" when they put him down.
Bullshit. Never. It was silent and somber.
And nobody went. Nobody started singing "You're Breaking My Heart, So Fuck You."
No. Right. Whatever. Whoever started that rumor is full of baloney.
All right.
It did not happen. I was there. I was sitting at the 2 feet away from where his grave, his thing gets lowered in.
Right.
And right behind Una, and George Harrison and all the
right
bigwigs at the front row. I had the second row.
I'll take the second row.
Yeah. What's that?
I said I'd take the second row. That's a lot of good company.
Yeah, but, you know, like, there was a grand piano in the living room. I could have started being Andy and playing piano, but it was a somber, it's a freaking funeral.
Right.
So sure. I didn't want to do that. Unless everybody else decided to play music, then of course I would.
Right, but you're not going to be the guy that starts it.
No.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So, anyhow, there's so many wonderful stories. Harry would take me over to Timothy Leary's house, and we'd, play music on the floor with upside-down instruments and stuff. Or he'd take me to Joe Walsh's house and listen to some demos that he made. Or he'd take me over to the guy who did Harry and the Hendersons, William, I can't remember the guy, Harry and the Hendersons. He was a keyboard player with Linda Ronstadt. Oh, boy. There's so many people I met through Harry. It's amazing, you know. And then, of course, sitting in Ringo Starr's house with Barbara Bach and in the living room, and there's two acoustic guitars with Ringo. And I said, do you mind if I play your guitar? No, go right ahead. So I pick up his guitar, and I just start strumming. Ding, jang, ka-jang, ka-ding, jang, ka-jang. And then Harry starts singing, I listen for your footsteps coming up the drive. And then Ringo comes in and starts singing with Harry. And here I am in the key of G, and the song's in the key of C.
Right.
But it's in the low register like this, and they're both singing low. And I'm strumming this G chord, and it's... Where else are you going to sit there with Ringo Starr and Harry Nilsson playing that song in the wrong key? It's fun.
Only in your life, Andy. The name you're looking for?
I know.
The name you're looking for? Was it Bill Martin?
Yes, thank you. It took you 8,000 years, but we finally got his name, Bill Martin. And he was cool ass. I sat on his couch with Harry, and I was stoned out of my gourd. And they decided both to be very mean pirates. And they were going, "Art, we're going to make him walk the plank," you know, and all this stuff. And I hear Harry's, you know, pushing his face into my face, and Bill Martin is pushing his face into my face there. "I'm going to get you," you know, and I was stoned out of my gourd, and it was hilarious. I mean, I was literally scared.
Crazy.
These two guys, they were having fun with me. It was fine. Because they're both incredible. Bill Martin was a hilarious person.
Sounds like it. Really creative. And to bring it all full circle, he wrote Earth Anthem for the Turtles.
Yes, he certainly did. And played keyboards for Ronstadt. And, I mean, the guy's been all over the planet Earth. He's a genius. He's done all kinds of stuff. You look at his bio, you go nuts.
Yeah, he's all over the place.
So that's what Harry and I do. Once we'd finish a recording session, we'd listen to the cassette in his Mercedes and drive all around.
Crazy.
Oh, let's go over Ringo's. Let's go to Harry. Let's go to Joe Walsh. Let's go over to Timothy's house. Let's go to Bill Martin. And he'd take me to all these places. I go, holy shit. Hanging out with Harry.
Was Harry a good friend of Bob Hope's?
Bob Hope.
Yeah, I seem to remember a weird connection between those guys.
There might have been. There might have been. You can Google it. I bet you might find something.
Who knows?
But he did Playboy After Dark, Hugh Hefner.
Right.
And Hugh Hefner owed him $15. So at one time, I was Harry's office boy. And I would write all these letters to different people. So I wrote a letter to Hugh Hefner, and Harry signed it, saying, "Hugh, where's the $15 you owe me?" So that was one of the funny things I did for Harry. Another funny thing I did was there was a radio station called Arrow 93 FM.
Right.
And it was Hollywood or whatever. And I said to Harry one day, Harry actually said to me, "I'll tell you what, Andy, let's put a radio tag on me on my Arrow." So I sampled the actual Harry Nilsson, "Me and my Arrow," and I stopped the sample. Then I created the ending, 93 FM, and we stuck it on with Harry singing 93 FM and made a little demo and brought it to the radio station as a gift. So I got a letter from the radio station thanking us for a special Harry Nilsson 93 FM Me and My Arrow spot.
That's amazing.
10-second spot. So this is the kind of shit we did. Another thing, he was going to invite Carol King over. We were recording Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, but he died. So our plans were to have her come sing harmonies with him on it.
And Harry's vocals hadn't been laid yet?
What's that?
Harry's vocals for that have not been laid yet?
It's already online. You can hear it online. If you Google Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, I think one of Harry's sons or somebody from his estate started posting all the demos I recorded.
There you go. I can't play them here because I fear the estate, but they're putting them up, so go
Google
this and go get them.
Trouble with copyright stuff. Yeah, that's very important. There's all kinds of great demos I recorded with Harry. Mother-in-Law, the song Mother-in-Law.
Ernie K. Doe.
Mother-in-Law. And I did it verbatim. I did a demo doctor version of the track that sounds exactly like the record.
Horns and everything?
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing, the whole arrangement, the little piano solo, everything, really exactly like the record. So Harry and I had a lot of fun doing a lot of great songs. We also, he wrote that song, This Could Be the Night.
Right.
This could be the night. And he wrote three new verses. And we re-recorded the song with three new verses about him chewing bubble gum in a car and the lights go out and the windshield wipers are broken.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, you helped Harry get his groove back, which was really, really important. Because prior to this, he'd had a really rough patch, man. He got ripped off
Cindy Sims was his trusted CPA for 9 years while he had his Hawkeye motion picture script division company.
Right.
And over 9 years, she took $8 million from Harry Nilsson. And just before they repossessed his house, he found out. And he, of course, had her arrested, but I don't think he ever recouped. But it was devastating.
Right.
To lose your fortune to this woman. And she had also stolen from other people as well. So Harry wasn't the only guy. Once he did the Primal Scream on Pussycats with John Lennon, he lost the upper range of his vocal.
He ruptured a vocal cord, didn't he?
Yes. You know when John Lennon does that Primal Scream?
Right. Yep.
But it's at full volume. And it's very destroying your voice. And Harry destroyed his upper end at that period of time. So he really had trouble hitting. He can't do all the beautiful, silky, high, amazing notes anymore. So all the demos that we recorded were in the tenor to baritone vocal range. So he actually, on a song I wrote called Karen, there's one part where he had to go, "Forever," and he was at the top of his throat, and he actually had to stop recording, get up, go to the bathroom, throw up, and then come back to the mic, have a glass of water, and finish singing the song.
Carol, Carol, Lord, my heart knows will go on and on forever. It's getting better all the time. And time
so hard for him to hit. I know. But Harry was a one of a kind because he was the only guy in the history of music who never toured.
That's true. He never toured.
He never did a Harry Nilsson show. He's done television and shit and movies, but he never did a live thing until I photographed him at the Beatle Fest that we did together.
Yeah, I was going to say, Beatle Fest is the only time I can think of him ever playing live.
Yep. Yeah, I took him to Beatle Fest, and actually, it was the owner, Mark somebody, I forgot, Spitz or Smith or Spiro, I can't remember, the guy who owns Beatle Fest.
Right.
In New York City, knocked on John Lennon's apartment door, and Harry Nilsson answered the door, because Harry was living with John. And the guy says, is John here? I wanted to ask his, and John says, who is it? And Harry says, some guy wants to ask you something about Beatle Fest. And John says, what? And he says, oh, I want to get your permission to do a convention called Beatle Fest, where all the Beatle fans gather together and buy paraphernalia and do all this stuff. Do I have your permission? So John Lennon says, sure, go ahead. So Harry was there opening the door for Beatle Fest to start. That was the time when John Lennon gave his permission. All these cool-ass stories. I mean, it goes on and on forever. So when I'm sitting writing my book, I get lost because I get sidetracked because something will remind me of something else. And then I'll talk about something else and it'll be, and I'll go around in circles. So it's really nuts.
And that's okay, man. You lead a life. A lot of us, you had a front row seat to things that a lot of us only wish we had seen, you know.
Oh.
And wow, amazing. Before we go, there's a rumor I wanna put to rest.
I love this. I can't wait to ask me this question.
Awesome.
I'm prepared.
There is a legend. That, you know, some people have heard that you are the guy responsible for the piano riff on the 1967 number one single Daydream Believer, that it was you who created that riff. Andy.
Okay.
True or not true?
All right. I have to tell the story because it makes it much more interesting. Flo and Eddie are comedians. Satire. They love to make fun. That's why they loved working with Zappa.
Right.
You know, with the satire and the amazing, clever routines. So they would incorporate that in their show. And what they did was to introduce the members of the band as somebody who they weren't. So when I was the keyboard player, and so they said, okay, you know what, Andy? I want you to learn Daydream Believer, and we're going to say you're the guy who played on that. And then the guitar player, Rick Guidotti, we're going to say that he hung out with Stevie Ray Vaughan, and we're going to do whatever that Stevie Ray, what's the name of that?
LaGrange?
You know, by Stevie Ray Vaughan. Yeah. And then the drummer, we say he's Simonized Santana's car. So we did the Santana song. And the bass player was the bass player on do-do-do. But it was all lies. It was all lies. But we toured for years and years and years and years. And he'd say, and on the keyboards tonight, Andy Kahn, who's the guy who played on this record. And I go, do-do-do-do-do-do. And everybody would cheer, and they'd right. think I was the guy who played on that song. And it turns out, of course, I wasn't. And a lot of people started blogs on the internet, like really angry, upset, very angry. Oh, how can Mark Foeman and the Turtles lie like that? But that was the humor. We actually played at a gig where a radio station guy was interviewing Mark, and it's on YouTube. I can show you the video. So what is this deal? Does Andy Kahn really play the keyboard part on Daydream, you know, Daydream Believer? Or whatever the name of his song is.
Right.
And Mark says, not really. We just do it as a show. We do it as a, you know, it's part of our show. And we're all laughing, you know. So anyhow, there is an internet website where there's this big blog about Andy Kahn and monkeys. But I am on a monkeys album called Pool It. I'm on a song that Davy Jones wrote called something about being in love with you or something. I can't even remember the title, but it's on the Pool It album.
I think it's called I Love You Forever.
Piano. Yes, that's what it's called. Yeah. And Davy Jones wrote it, and I play piano on the recording session. So it's a white lie. I play piano on a monkey song, but it sure as hell wasn't the rhythm section that played on everybody's hit record. Was it the Wrecking Crew? It probably was the Wrecking Crew or that other rhythm section, you know, the same ones that played on the Beach Boys.
The legend is that that actual riff was a Torque creation.
I bet you it was. I bet you it was.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Andy Kahn comes clean, ladies and gentlemen. Right here on Deep Dish Radio, Andy Kahn comes clean about the Daydream Believer controversy. You heard it here first. Lighten up, people.
It's a lie. Everything I've told you guys is a lie. I just need attention.
Well, then you will get it, especially when you finish this book and put it out there, because not only Andy and I have talked about this, and not only is it going to be chock full of stories, but Andy's personal archives are full of photographs and posters and tickets and mementos and probably hotel room keys and panties from a life on the road with musicians all over the world. And these stories that you hear, he's got tchotchkes. He's got evidence. He's got the Ark of the Covenant from all these stories.
Yes, this is a very exciting moment in history.
Well, I was going to say, to be fair, I have stood 3 feet from you while you played Daydream Believer. And, I mean, you're spot on. What can I say? But, of course, you're spot on for everything I heard you play that afternoon.
It was great seeing you. You know, I said, look at this guy. He's sitting right in front of me, and he just so happens to have a Flo and Eddie album in his little bag right there.
That's true. We'll back up. We'll tell the story. I was visiting my mom in Palm Springs for Easter weekend, and, you know, she happened to live in a place right across the street from where you were playing, and we're like, let's go find a place for brunch. So we breeze in, and there's a poster promoting Andy. And I'm like, this is a place for me. So we go in, we get a seat tableside, and I just so happen to have in my bag of tricks a Flo and Eddie album that was waiting patiently in the car because I was going to have it signed by the Turtles who were playing in the casino that same weekend.
Yes, correct.
The autograph never happened, but I did get backstage, which was cool. Thanks, Howard. But I end up 3 feet from Andy, and I'm listening to this guy play, and I'm like, this man is awesome. And so I look him up, and I'm like, he's on that album in my car. So I duck out, and I get the car, and I come back, and I'm like, hey, man. And so you were very gracious hanging out with me and my mom and my beautiful wife, and you just played amazingly for us. Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm very fortunate that my whole life has been music. There's been people I've grown up with that no longer play music. But I'm 68 years old, and that's all I've done is play music. So, like I said, I'm not the guy who had the hit record, but I sure played with everybody who did. And that's the cool stuff, that I get to hang out with icons, people that I grew up loving. It's just amazing. sitting there talking with him and hanging out with him. That, to me, like I said, I'm a fan who became a musician. It's like I became a musician out of the love of the Beatles, out of the amazement of that creativity of playing and singing and writing, all three things, and looking killer, too. You know, everything about the Beatles was so amazing. It really was. Everybody copied the Beatles immediately, including the Turtles. You know,
right down to the T-L-E-S in the name. All right, so let's get the plugs out. Andy, you got a website, you got a Facebook page. Where can people see you? Where can people hear you?
Okay, well, first of all, you can buy my CD, a digital download on CD Baby. It's CD Baby, and the name of the CD is, I'll spell it for you, Snarfle, S-N-A-R-F-E-L, Snarfle, by Andy Kahn, C-A-H-A-N, and it's on CD Baby, and I've got the whole album, including that Harry Nilsson track that he sang of a song I wrote. So that's a good way to do it. And, of course, my website is allentertainment.net.
All entertainment. So you keep it small. All entertainment.
And then my Facebook is hilarious. I should go to a 12-step program because I'm addicted to Facebook and my cell phone and my laptop. If those items disappeared, I would probably be lost. I would not know what to do with my life if I didn't have Facebook and YouTube and my cell phone and my laptop. I'm kidnapped by technology. I've been kidnapped.
People would think you're a teenager, Andy.
I tell you, it's a tough life. So, you know, I got to play music and I got to go sailing. And, oh, my God, I tell you, I'm living a very tough time here. I'm writing a book. You know,
and then you got to deal with guys like me who are like, hey, Andy, I need you to piss away 2 hours telling me stories that are going to be in your book anyway.
Oh, well, this is good. This is good. But the book's going to take some time because literally I need a software program, probably Photoshop or Microsoft Office. I have no clue because I got to really start building the page by page imagery along with the text because I'm going to literally build the book myself. Because it's going to have all this imagery going on. So it's besides actually physically writing the text, then you have to make it into a very interesting looking coffee table thing.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a lot of work. But you...
So it'll be a couple of years. I would say it'll take a year at least. I've been working on it for, a while. I covered my entire living room floor with photographs and documents so I can get to them, so I can see them. Because if they're in a filing cabinet, you have to go weeding through the filing cabinet to find it. But if it's all over your living room floor, you can literally see it. Oh, there it is. It's over there.
So there you go. Andy, when the book is ready to go, will you come back and hang with us?
Yes. Now, can I tell you one more story?
Yeah, man.
Mind? All right, we can, I know you have a lot of editing to do, but with that slice in the big city, you're going to have to put up with Andy's stories. Okay, I was on the, in 1973, I was the organ player with Michael Fennelly, who had a group called Crabby Appleton.
Go Back!
And you remember?
I remember Go Back. I also his single after that was called Touch My Soul, and it's amazing.
I know, and we did he did an album called Lane Changer.
Right.
And I was in the live band that performed with him, with John Bredo and Clark Gorman and I can't remember the guy's name on the bass. Anyway, so we played the concert in Spokane, Washington, Epic Records Tour, and King Biscuit and Dave Loggins and the Flash Cadillac and Sha-na-na and Michael Fennelly were on this tour, Epic Records. So we're taking off from Burbank and the Hughes aircraft, and the captain gets on the microphone and says, ladies and gentlemen, the wheel broke on our airplane. So we're going to be on the ground for 2 hours repairing our wheel. Free drinks for everybody.
Oh, shit.
Well, they just kept on flooding the cabin with free drinks. An hour goes by, and King Biscuit takes off his straw hat, and he puts a $20 bill in it. He says, all right, everybody, we're passing around a hat for a streaker. You know, because streaking was very big in 1973 when David Niven was streaked
on the Oscars, right?
So the hat filled up with $300 cash. And I said to myself, you know, I got to make a payment on my Mercedes. So I grabbed the money out of the straw hat, and everybody laughed. And I ran back to the back plane, took off all my clothes in the bathroom there, peeked my head out of the window, and I yelled, is it okay? And the pilots opened up the door, and the three old ladies in the front seat took out their cameras, and then I ran down the aisle naked, and then I ran back up the aisle, and I kept the $300, and I streaked an airplane.
And somewhere there's little Kodachrome Instamatic pictures of your butt.
Of my naked, hairy butt. Damn it, I tell you, I'd love to see that.
Well, surf the internet long enough, everything turns up, right? Oh, thank you for bringing up Michael Fennelly. Now I got to go back and play my Krabby Apple tonight. God, I love that cut.
Oh, he's got a Facebook an account, and we're buddies, and he posts a lot of his classic demos, and he's a great singer. He sang a song I wrote called The Mooch.
Oh, yeah?
And he actually sang it on stage, and the opening to the show that we did was a song that I wrote called 11 Times, and it was in a key signature of 11-8, and it went bow, bow, da-na-na-na-na, bow, bow, da-na-na-na-na, bow, bow, and it was rock and roll and big screechy guitars, and so we had a good time. He was fantastic.
Fantastic.
And then right after him, I went with Little Richard and Chuck Berry on the road. So it was like amazing shit. All in 1973.
And those are the stories you're going to get when you meet Andy Kahn. Believe me. Believe me. Look him up on the internet. You're gonna love what you hear. You're going to love what you see. These stories just keep coming. The man is an endless fountain of stories. And like I said, he had a front row seat through the best area of rock and roll. Andy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, my friend. Please stay in touch.
Oh, yes. And as soon as the book comes out, you'll be my premier outlet.
It's an honor. Thank you, my friend. Have a great night.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.